I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The policies and practices of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency landed on our doorstep with a deportation struggle involving longtime Lawrence resident Saeed Jamal. Today, the ethics professors examine the underlying moral issues of separating a family and of changing deportation policies with each federal administration. Then we'll talk about the right to privacy in regard to Governor Greitens' indictment and whether an area high school should memorialize a student the way her family wants. Later, make your plans with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The case of Saeed Jamal, the Lawrence scientist and father of three U.S.-born children who faces deportation for overstaying his visa, has attracted international attention. It's also drawn the attention of our ethics professors, who will be asked whether it's fair to have the fate of immigrants like Jamal be at the whim of the government, which, you know, occasionally changes its emphasis on who can stay and who must go. Other topics today for the professors: the privacy of the woman at the center of a Governor Eric Greitens scandal in Missouri, has it been respected, as well as the request by the parents of Gabby Keel, who committed suicide in 2016. The parents are asking that Gabby's name be read at what would have been her graduation from Harrisonville High School. The school has so far refused that request, but does the school have an ethical obligation to honor what the parents want? When the questions get tough, and I hope we have time to get to all of them today, the ethics professors are the ones we turn to. And today they are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC and a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. He's one of my bosses on campus. Wayne, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Adrian Switzer is a professor in the Department of Philosophy, also at UMKC. Adrian, nice to have you back as well.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, Wayne, how ethical is it for this country to consider deporting Saeed Jamal? On the one hand, he's been in this country since Ronald Reagan was president and has three children born in this country. But on the other hand, he overstayed his visa not once, but twice. Is it possible to sort this one out?
Well, I think it will have to be sorted out in some way. The question is, what are the legal and ethical obligations that we have to the people who are going to be impacted by those decisions?
Because obviously there are competing priorities.
Oh, absolutely there are. And there's one, and I think that, you know, interestingly, as I've researched or at least kept up with some of the issues with deportation, I think even some of the strongest voices against giving amnesty or just kind of granting people the right to stay in the United States are people who have immigrated legally because they feel, well, I've gone through all the right processes, I've gotten here legally, and now someone else is going to get what they would think an unfair advantage over them and what they had to go through. And so I think it's interesting that those who have legally immigrated are sometimes some of the have been some strong voices against those who are here who haven't gone through all the proper channels and legal framework. So certainly, if we're going to have a stable country, there have to be immigration laws and respect for those laws. And we are a country that is respects the rule of law. And if we're not going to have complete anarchy, people can't just decide when and when not to obey certain laws and regulations. And so that's something that does have to come into play. And then the question, and it's one that I think we would need different experts to really come in and talk about, but or what are the legal and potential ethical implications of some of the immigration laws and policies that are in place? Because those may be creating some real unfair disadvantages for some people legally trying to get into the country or creating obstacles that allow certain groups and other groups not to come in. So I think on the one hand, you would have to have an analysis of both the legality, but of the ethical implications of existing immigration policies that are in place now. That's kind of a side issue because the person we're talking about is in the country, acknowledgedly, who overstayed visas. did not comply with government regulations, and now has been here for decades and finds himself in a situation where the government is just going to kind of say, well, you didn't follow the rules, so we're going to cast you off and send you away. This raises, I think, a whole different set of issues. So we're not really talking about immigration policy now, because we could say that is what it is. But when we find someone who has been in the country for some length of time, perhaps illegally, perhaps they came in any number of ways in which they have now established residency here, the question is, do we have ethical obligations to that person in spite of the fact that they've broken the law in some way? And I think that we do.
Because some laws have statutes of limitations. I mean, at some point, the gig is up when it comes to prosecuting
Absolutely.
A certain law. Maybe not in this case, but in other cases.
There could be statutes of limitations, or there could just be the fact that the person has broken the law. But what are the consequences of particular actions for that person? So, you know, I was trying to think of this. I came in. You imagine yourself driving across the Death Valley in the desert, and you hear some rumbling in your trunk or something. You find someone has kind of stowed themselves away in the back of your trunk. What do you say? Hey, get out of my car and sit here, and you're going to die in the middle of the desert, and then drive off. I would think that you would probably have some ethical responsibilities, probably even legal responsibilities, not to do something to that person, even though they've done something that's illegal. They've trespassed upon your property. But you now find yourself in a situation where if you discharge them, just sit them on the side of the road in the middle of the desert with pretty good certainty that that person's going to die if you don't take them to the next gas station or someplace and make them get out in a place where they would be safe. I think you now have some ethical encumbrances upon yourself not to do something that's now going to cause or increase the likelihood of the death of that person. The analogy here, I think, is quite apropos because we're talking about a person who's been in this country. To pick them up, take them back where they have no family, no friends, and just kind of leave them there.
And could be in danger because he was in danger Bangladesh when he came to this country, at least he said. Yeah.
In danger, and even if there weren't sort of a governmental or whatever concerns that person might have, just to drop someone off with no provisions and no maybe no translatable job skills, no job opportunities, how is that person going to survive? And if they go over there, find themselves on the street, the victim of some assault, and die, is there not some moral culpability on the part of the person who has engaged in that act? So while I think we can say, hey, someone has broken the law, what do we care? I don't think that discharges our moral responsibility or culpability if we do something that now causes further harm to that individual. And I think that really kind of is fundamentally the question at play here with this individual that we're talking about.
Adrian, how do you sort through this difficult issue when you have such important priorities on either side of the ledger here? How do you navigate something like this?
Well, I think something you mentioned at the beginning about the kind of whims of governmental change, that certain policies are put in place and then another administration comes along, puts
and
in new
change.
Policies. I think one of the assumptions of both our political and ethical life is something like stability, some kind of predictability about how we should act, what are the kind of guidelines for good behavior, either ethical or political. And if you find yourself, I mean, I think this impacts us more generally, people who aren't going to face immigration reform kind of in a firsthand way. But if we feel our political kind of landscape and ethical landscape shifting every, 2 to 4 years, I think that does raise broader ethical questions and political questions for even those of us who, aren't kind of at imminent threat of facing these changes.
And this is why so many politicians acknowledge our immigration system is a mess, because there is no sort of certain set of standards. They do change from administration to administration. And here we are once again in a heck of a pickle because the spotlight has been shined so brightly on one individual whose case is drawing so much sympathy.
Yeah. I mean, something from philosophy the way in which we usually would talk about ethics from a philosophical standpoint is something like character development, that, people do good and bad things, but what we really want to reflect on when we consider their ethical status is their character. And, this person's been a meretricious contributor to our society for a long time, that his character has been formed and shaped by the society, and he's been kind of giving back to that society over a long term. So he's kind of meeting some pretty standard ethical measures from a philosophical standpoint. Mm-hmm.
Not meeting all of them.
Not all of them, right? Absolutely. Right. But one way we would go about, like, I think we all recognize that we make mistakes at times. But what we really think about when we think about someone's ethical kind of life as their character. And that takes time to develop. It takes a stable political and ethical community to be part of. And so, yeah, to have this shifting political and ethical landscape undermines the possibility of developing a good ethical character and having that kind of reflect back into society and this kind of give and take between the person and their broader community and society.
If our listeners want to chime in here on what they would regard as an ethical way to deal with the very difficult situation facing Saeed Jamal, we're all ears here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. We're visiting with our ethics professors, and the first topic on the table here is this very contentious case of Saeed Jamal. You know, Adrian, some might say that the need to keep a family intact would trump the need to follow a law in this case. Is it possible to weigh the priorities in that regard?
Well, it might be possible. It's certainly not going to be an easy equation.
Right.
As Wayne was saying, that if this person were to be displaced back to a society that he's not part of and hasn't been part of for many, many years, the same kind of risks then his family would face the same kind of risks here, that if he is the primary kind of breadwinner in the family, we're also potentially subjecting that family to certain hardships by tearing the family apart. So, mm-hmm. I don't think there is some way. Well, I mean, this is an ancient question about kind of about Antigone here, that the difference between your political responsibilities to your broader community and your responsibilities to your family. This has been around for several thousand years that we've been having these questions. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer this off the cuff exactly. But
yeah.
It's certainly like the place of family. We recognize that family is kind of a micro political unit, but there's going to be tensions between family obligations and political obligations. And,
mm-hmm.
Ideally there'd be a way to have them coordinate with one another in some way and talk, they'd be compatible with one another.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have to break apart families in order to kind of make political, kind of hard political decisions or vice versa.
There is this notion, and Adrian's mentioned it, Wayne, this idea that the playing field does shift from administration to administration here. Mm-hmm. And that's tricky because immigrants are playing the game under one set of rules. Then suddenly President Trump comes in and he says that ICE agents no longer can exercise prosecutorial discretion to consider the good community standing of offenders. So suddenly the rules for Jamal have changed. And I mean, is that fair?
Well,
that's the system we have, but it may not be fair just because it's the system we have.
Yeah, the broader question of fairness particularly trans-administrative fairness is troublesome because we anticipate and we understand that an electorate is going to vote in a different group of people because they want change. They want to bring in different administrative policies and procedures. And so you find yourself, I mean, everyone, though, is subjected to, whether they like it or not, the implications of a different administration's rules and laws.
But a lot of times when laws change in Topeka or Jefferson City, the law changes from that moment going forward.
Right.
They're not retroactive for people like Saeed Jamal who have been here for decades.
Right, that you have sort of a grandfathering in of certain procedures from maybe. But with him, it becomes difficult because the question is, well, when was it? When he first came in, was it when he extended his first visa, the second? When exactly, and what policies were in place at that time? Is it the time of discovery? I think it might be difficult to know exactly, well, what are you grandfathering him into in a
right.
particular situation? What I do find troublesome, though, and certainly the changing winds of politics is can be confounding and challenging and unethical in some ways. But just the idea that one doesn't use discretion, as you say, that there's kind of been this beating back of, well, we're going to treat everyone equally and fairly. Now, know, Kant, we could refer to philosophers, moral philosophers, who certainly would embrace the idea that that's exactly what morality is. Everyone is treated exactly the same, though I don't think that he would push that to the degree that to say you don't, you shouldn't be looking at the nuances of an individual situation to make true moral decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that we come into this ethical rub, is that some people, I think, trying to be fair and just, say, well, let's just don't think about those details, just treat everyone exactly the same. But they're not. And you're sort of fundamentally failing to recognize the fact that each individual has unique circumstances and situations. On the other hand, then you get into the challenge of, well, this person gets treated one way by one group of decision makers, and someone else with similar but different circumstances gets treated in what seems to be a different way. And they say, well, that's unfair and unjust as well.
Clearly, the administration's having second thoughts about deporting Saeed Jamal.
Absolutely.
They have brought him back, and there's a lot of wavering here, given all the publicity that's going on. Lots of phone calls here as we talk with our ethics professors about the case of Saeed Jamal. Let's go to some of them now. Bill from Lawrence, you're on Up to Date, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. And this may have been covered, but you know, I think the concept of justice bridges the gap between the law and ethics. And the court of law is always entitled to do justice, even in the face of a law that might conflict with the concept of justice. So that's my comment, for what it's worth.
This idea, Adrian, that justice bridges the gap between law and ethics, does that make resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, especially if you think about justice as a process that's shaped and determined by the court system, that justice is not a kind of fixed and determined. I mean, it's a bearing that the courts take, you know, that they're thinking about coming to the most just decision about these things.
But I think of justice, though, I think it could be interpreted as it applies one way to one individual and a different way to another.
Well, I was thinking about Kant. Interesting that Wayne brings Kant up, but
he always does.
Yeah,
good old Kant. Good old Kant.
I think Kant has a lot to offer us. I was thinking about the rule of law, which is another way to talk about justice. That the bearing of a court system is kind of towards the rule of law. And that there's an essential rationality to the rule of law. And so what we're talking about with justice is the court system building up a sequence of decisions that are building out the rule of law, but in a way that's kind of rationally understandable for persons? So this really radical shift from one administration having one policy, and then the next administration having a very different policy, mm-hmm. such that the court system cannot kind of articulate our rule of law and define our sense of justice in something like a rationally coherent
way. That's interesting.
And this brings up really a question that philosophers have, particularly in the 20th century, John Rawls and Nozick, John Nozick and Rawls, who debated this very issue, the question of justice, and they would, I think, on this very issue would come down on different perspectives. Nozick argued that very much justice was an entitlement, and so you are entitled to certain things because of your labors and your work. And I think he might come down on a perspective that, well, someone who is in the country illegally, they are not entitled to be here. And it's not an injustice that's being done that he might be deported, because he's not being denied something to which he was entitled, because he's not have the right to be here in the first place. Again, we still have to get into the question, I think, of the consequence of what's going to happen to that person. Rawls, on the other hand, would take a much more nuanced view and would bring into the question of, well, justice is fairness in terms of, would a group of people who find themselves in a situation argue that family values and everything that's being considered here with this particular individual, that we might not, that these super individuals looking down would say the principles of justice would not entail deporting someone, breaking up the family structures, because that would be most detrimental to the least most vulnerable people of our society, and that they should be protected. And so the caller's point about justice is incredibly good. And it only, unfortunately, well, good for philosophers, raises more questions about the fundamental definition of what we mean by justice. And I think you could find people coming down on different sides on this very question about whether he's being treated justly or not.
Robert from Kansas City, Kansas. Robert, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. Thanks, Steve, for having me on. I'm just going to get right into it. I think, he should be able to stay, as was pointed out earlier, if he's, split the family up, you're putting the family at risk because, if he's the primary breadwinner there, you're obviously putting them at risk, but then you're also putting him at risk because you're putting him back into a country, which he hasn't been in decades. So his life might be in danger, just for going back. I think he's more than put in his share, than even a lot of Americans, I would say. done his share of good deeds.
Right.
I do not think it's very ethical for them to, deport him back, to Pakistan. It's almost hypocritical. Just because, Trump himself, his parents or grandparents immigrated here. So,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of a sticky situation. Obviously every country needs border laws, but I think there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Well, we're going to have to leave our conversation right there. Robert, thank you for the call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics. We're going to focus on the privacy considerations involving the woman involved in the Eric Greitens affair scandal that's rocking Jefferson City. And hopefully we'll get to this question of how a graduate who committed suicide a couple of years ago at Harrisonville High School should be handled come graduation season this year. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we had Deval Patrick here in the studio, who's not ruling out a run for the presidency. In fact, I'd bet he is running. He might be the next big hope for Democrats in 2020. You can find our conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the show, how lawmakers in Topeka are responding to swatting. That's when someone fools the police into sending a SWAT team to raid a stranger's home. And we'll get tips for younger women involved in political leadership. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, for this hour, we're visiting with our ethics professors, and today they are Wayne Vaught and Adrian Switzer, both from UMKC, and we're talking now about our second topic of the day. This is the Eric Greitens affair that's, as I said before, has absolutely rocked state government. The governor now faces a felony grand jury indictment of invasion of privacy. It stems from a 2015 affair. The woman in this case has asked for privacy. She didn't break the law, and Eric Greitens was a private citizen when her relationship with him began. But yet, her now former husband released tapes to the media that disclosed her relationship with Greitens, who was governor when the tapes were released. The woman apparently didn't know she was being taped. The legal system has required her to testify. The media is going nuts with the story, and many people think it's only a matter of time before her identity is fully revealed. Wayne, she wants nothing to do with this. How ethical is this for her?
Yeah, this raises some very interesting and nuanced questions about the role of privacy, access to privacy in a very digital world in which pretty much everyone carries around with them recording devices and the ability to be displayed. And certainly public, you have issues about your behaviors or actions in public spaces that there's certainly a much less expectation that a person has a right to privacy there. You get into the situation surrounding this particular case of someone who was one purportedly, according to the media, was violated in terms of having photographs taken and then was doubly violated by having someone secretly record mm-hmm. them in what appears to be appropriate to state law. I guess it sounds Missouri is is a state that allows just one party to have to consent to recording. And I, you know, it raises real questions about the extent to which we should be taking more aggressive measures of protecting individuals' rights to privacy. You're seeing some statutes, and I think even some of the ones that are coming into play in this case are regarding what is revenge porn and other types of invasions of privacy and case law that's being built around that that's trying to protect that. You know, interestingly, there are no constitutional protections. It's not like there's a right to privacy. The right to privacy law that the Supreme Courts have recognized that have been most visible were around a case Griswold versus Connecticut, and then a subsequent case, which more people are familiar with, Roe versus Wade, which did establish constitutional grounds of privacy, which they even argued they talked about the marital bedroom, which kind of makes this kind of an interesting case in and of itself. But they weren't those cases weren't specifically dealing with taking pictures of people in various places and and what expectations a person might have of a right to privacy. In what's being put in the public, there's this interesting debate about whether in a public area, common area of one's private home, whether there can be an expectation of privacy. So obviously the prosecutors are wanting to say that this was a private area and other that it's not. I think that we should have a more robust conversation now and really need to have a robust conversation.
Because the world's changed so much, we need to get into this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the fact that I could right now take, you know, video record you, audio record, take pictures of you in just a just in a few seconds notice, do I have, you know, in a previous world, there are always, and basically if you take pictures of someone that you post, you would sign, you know, you'd have a camera, you'd sign waivers, you'd give your consent to have your picture taken. And, you know, and again, in a big public forum, it's difficult to say that. I want to take a picture of the street. It's going to capture images of people who aren't consenting to my photograph, but I think I have a right to capture those images. When I start going into certain places, you know, I question this Missouri law that only one person has to.
Other states have that law. It's only one person has to give permission.
Consent,
to,
and it can be the person recording you. And so
yeah.
I could record you without telling you I'm recording you. I think that that's troublesome, and it raises the issue of the woman as who's been the subject of multiple invasions of her privacy, and now a third invasion that she's being forced, apparently against her will, to come and testify. This is all goes back to, again, new technologies that didn't exist and rights and responsibilities of those people using those technologies and the rights and the rights that an individual has who's potentially going to be subject to the use of those technologies. And we just really haven't sorted those issues out. And I think that people ought have greater expectations of privacy than they have. And most of it has been sort of voluntarily. A lot of people post a lot of things about themselves on social media sites. And obviously there you can't have a whole lot of expectation about your privacy. And then people will get upset or concerned if someone takes that and starts using it. Well, it's like you've voluntarily given something up. She hasn't. And so that, I think, raises an interesting ethical question for us about to what degree has she been caused a moral harm. And I think that there's a good reason to suggest that she has been harmed.
Well, if we're talking about rewriting privacy law in this country, that sounds like it might be beyond the attention span of our current Congress. That sounds like really sticky stuff. Adrian,
absolutely.
I was going to ask you, you know, we're talking here again, weighing these two rights here, the victim's right to privacy versus the perhaps the right to prosecute illegal behavior in this case.
Right.
Two, again, very compelling interests.
Right. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said so far, that new technologies just force us to reflect on prior understandings of privacy and intellectual rights to property and all these kind of things. I think when a case might be made that it's in the public interest at this point to bring to the wider state and national attention, you know, the kind of activities of an elected official, that's, you know,
But when they occurred, he wasn't an elected official.
Well, I think this is also a very, this happened very quickly, but we are also living in a rapidly changing landscape in terms of gender politics. And mm-hmm. and I think cases are now being made both explicitly and implicitly that the way we've talked about consent between a male-bodied and female-bodied person just have to change. They've been in place for so long in an under-considered way. And I know this is very complicated. I'm, you know, just talking about the kind of Me Too movement, but it's very complicated for perhaps someone who this woman might not want to participate in something mm-hmm. like a changed political mm-hmm. landscape where she just, you know, she had this relationship or now relationship, you know, and just doesn't want to be party to this changed dialogue that's going on in our country. But and I think this, she's not the only one that's being swept up into this moment of being maybe a reluctant participant in a very rapidly changing way in which we talk about sex and gender and coupling yeah. And these kind of things. And so issues of privacy, I think, are being pushed in that in that context as well, not just changes in technology, but just in the last year or so, how quickly we've shifted in our conversations about you know, prior relationships. I mean, we read this in the newspaper that we'll hear something from someone out of a relationship a decade, 15 years ago, and something emerges from that maybe 10, 15 years ago, not to say it was right, but it wasn't talked about or kind of judged in the terms that we now talk about it. And now suddenly people are... So a very quick change, I think, in the politics and ethics of gender and sexuality.
You know, as we sit here today, you just have to wonder how she's navigating this herself, because you could almost bet dollars to donuts that her identity will be revealed at some point here. And you just wonder how that will play out. We can't guarantee her privacy. You said there's no constitutional right to privacy. I mean, you can almost predict it's going to come at some point. She'll be revealed at some point.
Right. We are always in a balance of the rights of our individual freedoms and the rights of the greater community. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Constitution of itself was an attempt to articulate the balance of those rights in terms of what were the absolute protections that an individual should expect. And on the flip side, what are the responsibilities of a government to ensure the health and welfare safety of its people? And so to the degree that this becomes sort of a very clear utilitarian type of ethical analysis, is that if the greater good is to be served by limiting or restricting certain aspects of an individual's rights or privacies, those can be justified with a greater conversation to the degree that the greater good is served by mm-hmm. limiting those particular rights. But you have
certain rights as a private citizen. You go into politics, you run for office, and a lot of that gets stripped away.
So. Almost all of it. And mm-hmm. and for good reason. You're putting yourself now in a public arena, and certainly in terms of things that you might say about your own character or your own values or the way that you're articulating how you're running, I think exposes you to an inspection and a kind of, we're going to pull apart the covering of privacy, because mm-hmm. you are in a position to have great influence, great power, and potentially inflict great harm on the people that you are now serving. And so those people have a right to expect a greater level of transparency. And that's, you know, the one issue, even when people get accused, like in this case of, you know, well, this is a family matter and we've handled it in this way and please protect our privacy. Well, you want to do that, but on the other hand, the public does have a right to know what's going on, because this is a public official. And so, again, you have a retraction, I think, of the protections that a common citizen might have. The issue here is that one of the women involved is just a citizen. She's not a public official, and yet is being thrust into the stage in a way that she may not want.
Or ever imagined.
And does the public have a right to that information because of its entanglement with the public figure? It really is a fascinating, challenging, and I'm not coming saying I have exactly the right answers, other than to say I think that for all there is a bit of a more limited expectation of privacy than there might be for some others.
You know, maybe an interesting point Wayne just made, Adrian, this idea that there are no right answers here. There are only, you know, alternatives here. There really isn't a right answer and a wrong answer. It's just picking among these very difficult options that are before us. Am I seeing that correctly?
Yeah, in this, unfortunately,
society tends, in our political atmosphere, we tend to say right, wrong, Democrat, Republican, good, bad.
Right.
And these situations don't strike me as fitting any of those.
Right. Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, as Wayne said, kind of good for philosophy, but maybe not so good for...
It's a growth industry right now, right? Enrollment's up these days,
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, ethical matters are just... they're difficult, and I think political matters are difficult to navigate, and they're always going to be connected with one another. To live together in a community and to live together in a society, they're going to touch one another and interact with one another. So one of our assumptions, I think, of a political figure is that they're going to be something like a moral exemplar. That, you know, Governor Greitens might not have thought of himself that way in being a politician. Maybe he's just interested in kind of legislation, or he's a little, you know, like he just might have been interested in the legality of life. But then he becomes a political figure and a public figure. And in that moment, we do hold our public and political figures to a kind of moral exemplarity, and whether that's fair or not is a question.
Mm-hmm. Let's do this. We have just a few minutes left. Let's get to our last segment today that I've already promoted, so maybe I should get to it. The parents of Gabby Keel, who committed suicide in 2016, want her name to be read at what would have been her graduation from Harrisonville High School this spring. The school's refusing to do it. It will recognize her with an empty chair instead, draped with a gown, and her name will appear in the program. My question, Adrian, does the school have any sort of special ethical obligation in a case like this, a very sensitive case, to honor the parents' request?
Right. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, just to begin, obviously, the deepest sympathies for the family.
Absolutely.
for their loss. This is difficult. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the case, so I don't want to kind of speak out of turn that the school is going to have an empty chair for her and put the...
There are gestures, you know, being made.
And so I'm not sure why the family feels like, you know, the name in addition to what with the gesture that's already being made would be something more, or that, you know, that the... I would worry that maybe the family feels like if her name is not announced with everyone else's, that she's somehow not being recognized in a full...
It takes away from her life,
right,
somehow.
Right. And there is something, you know, about our... This is a little bit abstract, but there is something about our names and the way in which we're, you know, that we put names on graves and that we kind of commemorate people by their names. There is something significant about our names. We might not think about that in our daily life because we just kind of trade in our names and just, you know, use them. But our names do have some potential memorial force to them. And so the reading of names, I'm thinking about how on a different topic, but how Governor Scott, right, the governor of Florida, mm-hmm. when the first legislative assembly after the Parkland shootings, he began that assembly by just kind of slowly reading through the names of the victims at Parkland. And there is some force to just hearing the names mm-hmm. of those who we've lost, and this poor family who've lost their daughter. Then the force of hearing that name read, I think it does. It's a little bit hard to put your finger exactly on what significance that does have, but I think when we hear, or if we go to the 9/11 memorial,
yes.
and if we just read the names,
the annual reading of the names,
I think there is a significance to that.
I should just take this opportunity to give out the suicide hotline. It's 1-800-273-TALK, just in case people want that information. You know, Wayne, the fact that Gabby died as a result of suicide, I just read the hotline number. I'm wondering if that's a factor here. Her family fears the decision by the school is driven by the stigma that can accompany suicide, mm-hmm. and they're battling that, I think.
Yeah, and I would, it would be inappropriate for me to put thoughts into the heads of the people who are making these decisions, because one might assume that they're doing what they think is best for themselves and the community and trying to be sensitive. I do think that, you know, it does probably reflect just a more general societal challenge that we just don't like talking about death in general, whether that be end-of-life decision-making, which I, as a bioethicist, have worked with pretty much my entire career,
sure.
about getting people to want to talk about the issues around their end-of-life decision-making. And that's tough even with elderly people, with people who die, unfortunately, or find themselves in an accident, a young person who's now in a coma and having to make very tough decisions about themselves. We're not comfortable with that. And certainly suicide, I think in part because it's an untimely death, but it's a death that has been enmeshed with illegality for many years, or immorality, both religious and otherwise. Kant, come back, did not think that suicide was morally, actually thought it was an immoral act. So you have those challenges, I think, that are absolutely swirling around. And as I read the brief thing in the paper, just said that they were concerned about the sadness of it. What we need is a society that can embrace each other and recognize the inevitability of death, and that we can, in fact, help. This family needs help. They're still in a grieving process. This is obviously challenging. And as Adrian has said, the reading of the name, just that reading of the name, is going to give a legitimacy or a reality to their daughter, that it's going to take a few seconds. We've done it at UMKC. I've given posthumous degrees to, and had, you know, a family member come up and accept the degree. And I can tell you that that is, it's not about the person who's died. It's about the family. It's a way of acknowledging them. And then I also worry about what this is saying, because I trust that this is, as you've given out the suicide hotline number here, it's because we recognize there are other kids in that school who have contemplated suicide. And if the school is sending a message that this is something to be shunned, or we're not talking about it, or this needs to be put off on the side, I would worry that that might discourage some other student at that high school from coming forward to a counselor, talking about my suicide thoughts, and not getting the help, and then we have another victim. So I think that there are just better ways in which the school could do this. Personally, I think seeing a chair with a robe draped over it is would be more distracting to me than just simply reading the person's name, letting them go across, and so really providing an honor and recognition that this person was amongst us and is valued. So
we're going to have to leave our conversation there with our good ethics professors today. Great conversation. Wayne Vaught, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. Adrian Switzer, professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Well, thanks for having us. Yeah, it was fun.
Bet, as always. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.